This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Gun-related bills are piling up in Ohio's legislature. And Attorney General Jay Vost is investigating tech giants like Google and Facebook, and he's getting a boost from the federal government. We start today's Friday News Review with Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being here. And we also have reporter Joe Ingles. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Join our conversation today at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Let's start with this gun situation. The Senate is looking at 7 new gun bills in a committee. What can you tell us about all these bills and where they stand?
Well, this is Joe, but the impetus for all these gun bills right now is the situation in Dayton that we had in August, where a mass shooter went into a nightclub. In 32 seconds, he killed 10 people, injured 27, and the police got to the gunman, but very rapidly, there were a lot of people injured or killed. And so this has an outcry in the legislature for these different pieces of gun legislation. And there are 3 bipartisan bills. And the reason I'm telling you about the Dayton situation is it actually is the area where Senator Peggy Lehner, a Republican, she got on board with some of these gun bills. And she says it was because, you know, Dayton was hard for her to watch that happen. And so she's gotten behind these bills and the 3 bipartisan bills. One would raise the age to purchase a gun from 18 to 21. Another would strengthen the background check system. And a third would speak to that red flag law. It would allow a judge to issue an order to temporarily remove guns from someone thought to be dangerous, but that person wouldn't know about that beforehand and couldn't present their side of the story.
Peggy Lehner is a Republican from Kettering. And Joe, you quoted her as saying it's every bit as much pro-life legislation as protecting the unborn from abortion.
What does
that demonstrate about the evolution of Republicans on this type of legislation?
Well, I'm not sure we can extend it to the evolution of Republicans, honestly. I think it's her evolution, her personal evolution of her thought process on this. But if you look at some of the other Republicans out there, Republican Senator Bill Seitz, he's calling these 3 bills ill-conceived. And he says they're a non-starter in that chamber. If you look at the House and Senate leadership, they haven't gotten behind those bills. They may have pulled Peggy Lehner over and maybe a couple of other people, but there still is a lot of there are a lot of questions about it, and there's a lot of reluctance to move that far that fast.
I want to jump in. Peggy Lehner, Joe's point is absolutely right that Peggy Lehner has jumped on this. She had raised concerns about some gun regulations back last year when the legislature was discussing this so-called stand your ground self-defense bill. She was very concerned about voting for that when she said that maybe there should be some other measures that should be considered. But also, once she signed on to this after the Dayton shooting, and she tweeted out that she was signing on to these ideas and encouraging other Republicans to join her, she joined with a bipartisan group of mayors who were here to lobby lawmakers this week and stood up there. And one of her first things that she said was that she apologized for not being on board with them sooner and encouraging others to join with her. And so that's her, but there are definitely other Republicans who are not on board with this. And Speaker Larry Householder has told us that there are probably 10 or 12 people in his caucus in the House who would not vote for any of these changes. So I don't know that it's Joe's right. I don't think it's an evolution of all Republicans. I think some Republicans have moved on this. Other Republicans are very clear in how they feel about it as well.
Well, then, so to be clear, the 3 bills that are being described as bipartisan, raising the firearm, the age to purchase a firearm from 18 to 21, the background check system, the red flag law, they're described as bipartisan just because Senator Peggy Lehner, a Republican, is supporting them, or are there other Republicans?
No, technically, if there's one, you know, one person from each party on board, they're considered bipartisan. This is a lot of legislations like this. You may only have one person or two people from a party. So that's why they're considered bipartisan. But right now, we don't have a lot of Republican senators coming out on this, on any of these bills and saying we want these.
And also, these are different than whatever we're waiting to see from Governor Mike DeWine. Right after the Dayton shooting, he came out with a package of 17 proposals that he wanted to enact, and some of which he's done through executive order. He's made some changes. But the whole big package that included a version of the red flag law, some strengthening of background checks, we have yet to see those. And those are different. Whatever comes out from the governor's office and whatever he backs is different from this package of seven bills that got their first hearing in the Senate this week, including the three bipartisan bills that you're talking about right now.
Yeah, there are four other bills that were heard, and they're sponsored by Senator Cecil Thomas, a Democrat from here in Cincinnati. What's the difference in his proposed legislation?
Well, they would go further, first of all. But the four Democratic bills, one would ban those bump stocks that make the gun fire faster, like that. You know, that would ban that. Bump stocks are those little kind of machines that they put on a semi-automatic to make it work more like an automatic.
And blamed in the shooting in Las Vegas a couple years ago.
Right. And then another would do the background checks, go out there, but it would also outlaw what are called straw man sales. And it goes further than the bipartisan background check legislation. The third would be that age thing again, taking it from 18 to 21, but it would also have some other things that are not in the bipartisan bill to make that even tougher. And then the fourth would close that gun show loophole. It would basically, if you were to sell a gun at a gun show, you'd almost have to go to a retailer in most cases to actually finalize that sale so that you could run the background check there.
Oh. And that idea that Democrats want to go further, that's been the story all along.
Yeah,
that even a couple years ago, as the legislature was expanding gun rights, I mean, when former Governor John Kasich, before he had kind of a turnaround late in his last year, or late in his last 2 years in office, he had signed every piece of gun rights legislation that had been put in front of him. And some of these were to allow guns to be carried into daycares, on college campuses, in bars, in certain parts of airports. So gun rights had been expanded all along, and Democrats had been talking for a long time about coming up with ways to do more background checks and pull back on that, and those bills really went nowhere. And so it's interesting now that these bills at least got a hearing, but in the Senate, I mean, Democrats are outnumbered 2-1 by Republicans, so it's, I think, kind of unclear at this point whether these bills are going to move beyond this first hearing.
Yeah, Joe, you reported in the story about the seven bills, it's doubtful that the bills will pass the legislature, but Democrats who want to get on board behind stronger gun bills are using this as an opportunity to put that support on the record. So they must see this as something that can be used on the campaign trail eventually.
Well, and if you look at the polling, if you look at the latest Ohio poll, which was a couple of months ago, when they start talking about background checks, when they start talking about, you know, tightening up gun safety issues, you see very, very high support for that. And so that's why a lot of Republicans are even looking at that saying, hey, do we want to be over here, you know, dealing with you know, trying to make guns more accessible, or do we want to be over here closer to where those polls are? So, you know, I think there is a movement right now, and we can feel it here, toward more gun legislation.
And I think there's also a big thing that's out there, too, in a potential ballot issue that could come on the November ballot next year, which would make big changes in the gun background checks process. And right now, petition circulators are out there gathering signatures. I've talked to one of them, and she says she's on the college campus at she's on campus at Ohio State University, not having any trouble getting kids to sign. And I've heard of other reports of people lining up to sign these petitions at farmers markets and other places where these circulators are working. 90% in a Quinnipiac poll said that they support gun background checks. And so it's kind of a situation where lawmakers, if they don't do something, something and this gets on the ballot, then the voters have decided what's going to be done. And I think there are some lawmakers who are concerned about that, looking at the way, for example, casinos went through. For several years, casinos were on the ballot and voters rejected them, but lawmakers didn't make any changes. Then finally, voters did approve casinos, and now lawmakers are dealing within the parameters of what voters eventually decided.
And, you know, one more thing. You remember the whole medical marijuana issue? You know, there was strong support for medical marijuana. And so the lawmakers thought, hey, someone's going to put this on the ballot. It's going to be passed in a way that we don't want. So let's go out there and create our own medical marijuana program. They did that in large part to avoid having something that they saw as even more unfavorable to them. So when you look at this groundswell of support for gun legislation, they're also looking at, the lawmakers are looking at it saying, hey, you know, we may get stuck with something we really hate. So maybe if we step this way in this direction a little bit, we'll just calm everyone down and it will go away.
Well, speaking of elections, we're also dealing with some voter registrations, 235,000 removed by county boards of elections earlier in September. And now Secretary of State Frank LaRose says he's going to continue working with voter groups about how many active voters may have been removed. What's the latest on this?
Well, first of all, 235,000 weren't removed. They were on a list that were targeted for removal. And when I spoke to Secretary of State Frank LaRose earlier this week, he said that of that 235,000, he distributed that list to voter rights groups, and they started reaching out to those voters.
Oh, they were identified as inactive.
Right. And 14,000 of that group of 235,000 then reactivated their voter registrations. They went online or they did something. They sent a card in. They signed a petition. They did something that reactivated their voter registration. So we don't know the final number yet of how many actual voter registrations were deleted by county boards of elections. They were supposed to report that to the Secretary of State's office last Friday, and he hasn't given us a tally on the final number that were, as voter rights groups called, purged from the rolls.
And what's the deadline then for people to figure this out in case they've been impacted by this and want to vote in this year's election?
Well, October 7th is a voter registration deadline for this November. So if someone finds out that they were on that list and they were taken off the rolls, they could theoretically go right back in and sign up. But the thing is that this list, you know, they don't have, the Secretary of State is going to give it to the groups that were out there trying to find the voters who were on that initial list to be removed. And they're, you know, the Secretary of State will give them the list again, and it will be up to them to go out and find the voters who were removed to say, hey, you've only got until October 7th to get this done. Get out there and do it. And the longer that we go without having that list to those groups, the shorter the time period for those voters who might have been on that list and might have been removed, the shorter the time period for them to act.
Now, I talked to Frank LaRose about that, the idea that he's distributing to that list to the voter rights groups who then can take action to try to re-register these people by the deadline that Joe said of October 7th. Earlier this year, there was a process that was started under former Secretary of State John Husted before he left office and became lieutenant governor that Frank LaRose continued. So there was a purge in February of a whole bunch of voter registrations. He then, I think it was 267,000, something in that area. He then sent out 270,000 voter registration forms to those addresses, hoping to try to capture some of those people if anybody was removed and really wanted to still be on the list. He spent $130,000 sending out these 270,000 voter registration forms. He got 540 back. So that's an awful lot to spend, I think. But he says, you know, even if you get one voter, it's a good thing. Now he's kind of turned that over to the voting rights groups and said, we want to try to get these people back on, but it's going to be up to you to figure out how to do that and to reach out to them.
Okay, we've just got about a minute left, and I want to ask about what Attorney General Dave Yost is doing with this investigation into big tech giants like Facebook and Google. What's happening here?
Well, he's one of nine AGs in the country who are going into this antitrust battle against Facebook and Google. And, you know, Yoast is basically saying that those companies are taking data. You know, if you use Google, you use Facebook, you're giving them information, but you're getting that service for free. And he's saying that that has value, that data you're giving them. And but since it's not traditionally like a, it's not like a phone service or something like that, that's a straight out where the customer pays, it's really hard to kind of apply these antitrust laws to it. So they're going around the state, Yoast and some state leaders. They're holding some hearings, a couple of hearings, and they want people to share their stories about how their security has been compromised so that they can actually roll that into part of the argument that they're making, that Facebook and Google are so big that they're kind of dangerous and need to be broken up.
Karen Kassler and Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, thanks to both of you for sharing your great reporting with us today.
Thanks. Well, thanks for having us.
Hundreds of local investors may have been bilked out of their money by house flippers. And Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin is facing questions over his use of a state-owned plane. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
They are a team of remarkable people, sworn to protect the world from misinformation, from spin, from political bias masquerading as news. There when we need them to tell the stories that must be told. They are the reporters, Totenberg, Simon, Beardsley, Rizdahl, Inskeep, and even Peter Sagal.
Okay, maybe Sagal's a different kind of hero, but the rest of them are here to save the day with their journalistic superpowers, standing for the facts and holding the powerful accountable. Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson. You know, Stan Lee once said that a superhero is a person who helps others simply because it should be done. A perfect reason for a donation to this station. Here's how you can save the day. And thanks.
On any given day, you'll hear news that inspires you and makes you think. And if we're doing it right, you'll hear something that challenges you. Occasionally, you'll also hear a reminder like this, asking you to support your favorite public radio station by contributing. It takes just a few minutes at WVXU.org or call us 513-419-7155. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Build Realty is facing a lawsuit that could reach class action level if a federal judge decides so. More than 600 investors across the region say they were ripped off by this house-flipping operation. The Friday News Review continues now with WCPO reporter Paula Christian. Hi, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So glad you could come in. This was quite a story that you reported. I want to get into the details about some of the people who were impacted because you talked to them, and it's really, really sad to read about how much money some of these folks lost. But before we do that, tell us about Build Realty, which I understand may use some different names.
Yeah. So this story took me quite a while to put together because truly a lot of the people who say they were victimized did not want to be interviewed publicly because they were embarrassed. So it took me quite a while to find people that would appear on television and would allow me to use their names. But Build Realty is kind of at the center of this large business model that operates under a lot of different names, a lot of different LLCs. And if you believe what the victims say, it's tied in with a title company, with lenders, with real estate agents who they say are all in cahoots in this very sophisticated fraud scheme to take advantage of people who want to learn how to flip houses.
So how do these prospective investors get in touch with these flippers?
Well, the signs are all we're these all are the people over the tri-state.
They put those signs out. I saw some of the photos in your story. So when you're driving off the highway or down
the
street,
busy intersections everywhere, and you know, at the peak of the operation, the lawsuit says they were putting in 1,000 signs a month.
Wow.
They would pay people to just install signs everywhere. They offered seminars, free seminars, where you could come and they would teach you how to flip a house. They put the seminars on YouTube. They had a very aggressive social media campaign. So they reached out to a lot of people.
And this is one of those professions, you know, like opening a coffee shop. Maybe it's something that we all have in the back in our minds we'd like to do someday. I'd like to put a little money in a house and flip it sometime.
And who doesn't like HGTV?
Exactly. So you're all inspired to get involved and you've got a little bit of money saved up. And so tell us about the type of person that got lured into this.
Well, you know, my initial thought from years of reporting is just, you know, these people must have been not paying attention to get caught up in something where they say they lost so much money. But what I learned in talking to so many people who say they were victimized is they were really from all walks of life. These were not just low-income people. These weren't just middle-class people. These were people that had some pretty high-level jobs, assistant principals, doctors, professional general contractors, all kinds of engineers. I mean, but they just, sometimes they want a little investment income. Sometimes they just, they thought it was a good way to save a retirement. You know, it ranged the gamut.
So what happens exactly if you're ready to give some money to a project? How does it all work?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is who you believe. If you believe Build Realty very much claims that they are a legitimate business model, that they have had, you know, thousands of successful deals, and that a lot of their clients have made money. So it's important to keep that in perspective. They are fighting this lawsuit. If you believe the victims, they say it's $10,000, and that's you know, their initial investment, and they think they buy a property. They think it's a down payment for a property, but it's not. It is. They form an LLC, and the houses are actually owned by a trust that they allege Build Realty actually, you know, still owns the house. It's complicated. It's very complicated.
Yeah. So like the money would then be used to purchase a house, but it would not be in the control of the
exactly.
new investor. It'd still be in the control of Build Realty.
Yeah. So what happens is they get financing to rehab the houses. So say they look at a house, it's going to cost Build Realty will say it's going to cost $50,000 to bring this house, you know, up to snuff to get it sold. And so they take out a loan and they pay an interest-only loan on the rehab costs. And if the problem in the people I spoke to is there's a lot of unexpected repairs that happens once you get behind the walls and you see the knob and tooth wiring and the rotted floor joists and the plumbing stack that needs to be completely replaced, there's no money in there for that. So all of a sudden, they're dipping into their own pocket, taking out credit card loans to try and make up the difference. They're falling behind on their payments and they lose the house they thought they owned, but they didn't.
And so there are people who are suing, and
yes.
this could become a class action lawsuit, but it's not yet?
It's not yet. This originated in state court a couple of years ago, and they say, the attorneys say, they discovered enough evidence to prove that it's a racketeering case, which those don't come up very often in civil cases. They're alleging a widespread racketeering conspiracy in which the real estate agents, the lenders, the title companies, everybody was in on it together. So if the judge agrees to give it class action status, it can open it up from the three people that are currently suing to, they say, 600 people across Northern Kentucky, Southwest Ohio, and Indiana.
So when do we find out whether it reaches the level of class action? Is this something that a federal judge is considering, right?
It is before Judge Michael Barrett, and he has to make that decision. So in federal court, there are no timelines for anything. So, I mean, it could be 2 months from now. It could be a year from now. It's just sort of pending.
And the realty company is still doing their business.
They are. And in fact, they have expanded into Northern Kentucky. So, which is one of the things the attorney for the plaintiffs, Bill Markovitz, said he was very surprised that when they have such harsh and severe allegations leveled against them, instead of trying to curtail it, they're actually expanding.
WCPO reporter Paula Christian. You can read this story at WCPO.com. Paula, we really thank you for coming in and talking to us about it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Days after her father was convicted of illegally contributing to her failed run for the U.S. Senate 5 years ago, Kentucky Secretary of State Alison Lundergan Grimes had a computer seized from her office. Meanwhile, Governor Matt Bevin is facing some questions over his use of a state-owned plane. The Friday News Review continues now with Courier-Journal reporter Joe Sonka. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Michael.
And we have Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRochers. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. You can join us as well at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show. Joe, let's start with you, and we'll start with Governor Bevin and the state-owned plane, because it's escalated to a point to where your own editor there at the Courier-Journal is tweeting about the importance of this story in response to some of the comments that are coming out of the governor's mansion. So just briefly for our listeners, give us a little bit of background on how this whole thing started.
Sure. So a few weeks ago, I looked at a flight tracking website where you can track where certain planes are going. And I noticed that the plane, the state-owned plane that the governor usually uses, has been really picking up at the amount of travel over the past 3 months over the summer, including trips to about 10 other states. So I asked the governor's office, what were the purpose of these flights? Were these official duties, part of his official duties? Were these personal reasons? Was he going to campaign fundraisers? And they flatly refused to answer. So I wrote a story about their refusal to answer, and noting that this isn't illegal. There's no requirement for a governor in Kentucky to release his daily schedule. Governors are allowed to use the state planes for personal reasons, as long as they have the state is reimbursed for those costs. And this has been an issue for governors going back decades. Republicans used to hammer former Governor Steve Beshear for using the state plane for political reasons. So I wrote the story, and then a couple days later, Governor Bevin was asked about the story and said, basically, as long as private entities reimburse the state for his use of the state state-owned plane, then it's none of their business. Were his direct words for what he was doing on those trips, and it kind of escalated from there. And Daniel wrote a great story in the Herald Leader looking at Bevin's use of the state plane over the course of 2016 and 2017, Bevin's first 2 years in office, and all of the unanswered questions about why he was taking so many of those trips.
Well, let's bring Daniel in. Give us your perspective on how this story's unfolded.
Yeah, so there was something in that Bowling Green statement that the governor said. He said, you know, if the public paid for the trip, then they have the right to know the reason that they took the trip. And I had been collecting, you know, it had been a battle for a really long time, kind of collecting this data from state police and from the governor's office. You know, you have to get the reimbursements from one, you get the flight logs from the other. And, you know, I kind of had a picture of the trips that he had taken, but, you know, how it is in journalism, the stuff kind of piled up and piled up and piled up. And so when he made that comment, it kind of made it clear that, well, they weren't giving us a reason for the trips that the public had paid for. Because I had this list of trips that I had sent to his office and said, what's the reason for these trips? And they just cited security reasons as a reason why they could not tell us why the governor had taken these flights. And, you know, that's inconsistent with the scheduling excuse that they had given as well. And so, you know, I just kind of put out that story. There were 67 flights that we tracked, and, you know, it was a total of $377,000 right around there. And about 49% of that was reimbursed. So it was either reimbursed by him, by the governor himself, by his campaign, by the Republican Governors Association. Some were reimbursed by the Heritage Foundation. So there were reimbursements going on for some of these political trips he was making, but we still didn't know the reason for a lot of them. And the reason that that's important is because without knowing the reason, we can't know whether or not the flight should have been reimbursed in the first place, right? You just see all these different destinations. You don't know if he's making that trip for an economic development purpose or if he's making that trip for a political purpose. And so finally, last night, they just kind of spewed out this list of different reasons for, you know, say the date, and it would say a reason. And sometimes it didn't include the city, sometimes it didn't include, you know, just kind of gave a reason, right? There were several that just said economic development meetings. And so now today I've been trying to go through and cross-reference all of them. I don't have anything out yet because I'm trying to match them all with my database. But they, you know, we're still trying to track down, you know, why did he go on these trips? Were all of them fully reimbursed? The governor's office says that they have followed the law by the book, that they've reimbursed everything that they need to reimburse. And, you know, they've almost treated this whole news cycle as kind of a nuisance.
And Joe, the governor did release some information on Thursday, but as Daniel points out, it looks like journalists are considering, and certainly his Democratic opponents are considering this incomplete. But the governor boasted about being very transparent with the release of this information. So, but it's not.
Yeah, I've probably been spending today doing the same thing that Daniel's doing, is going over these dates. And there are so many dates where there isn't an entry where the governor absolutely took a trip. And I'm finding that in August, for example, there were half a dozen trips that the governor took to campaign fundraisers and political events. But those aren't listed in this official list that released yesterday. And you have an example, one of the more recent entries in this list on August 28th, he says that he traveled to a development conference. He doesn't name the city, but the city was Alabama, where they had this conference. But this entry does not also mention that after that conference was over, he took that plane to Miami, where he was for 4 hours, and then he flew back to Kentucky on the state plane. No one has any idea what the governor did in Miami while he was there. And its inclusion on this list suggests that no one has reimbursed the state for that trip. So the question is, what was the governor doing in Miami? Do we have a right to know that? And has the governor's office or the governor's campaign or Republican entity reimbursed the state for the price of that trip, which was billed at nearly $8,000?
The governor is up for re-election this year. He faces a tough opponent in Attorney General, the Democrat Andy Beshear. Daniel, have we heard from Andy Beshear on this issue?
Yeah, Andy Beshear has been really kind of hammering this issue. He's been making multiple videos on Twitter, making statements on social media, just saying like that this is, the governor has a responsibility to let taxpayers know about all of this. He's pledged to give the reasons for all of his trips should he be elected in November. The governor's office has been quick to point out that, you know, it's a little bit, their word is hypocritical of the attorney general, since he, as a family member of the former governor, Steve Beshear, was on the state plane for trips that weren't always reported to the press. But of course, there is that firewall between that was his father's administration and is not necessarily his administration. And so, you know, this is like Joe said from the beginning, this is something that has always been a campaign issue for governors, because think about the extravagance of a state plane, right? Like the average person doesn't get to take a plane whenever they have to go to a specific meeting. And so it's kind of like low-hanging fruit for campaigns to really hammer on and hit on. You know, Steve Beshear had this as an issue when he was running in 2011. Before that, Ernie Fletcher, the governor, had that as an issue when he was trying to run for re-election. All the way back to like Julian Carroll in the 70s had this be a campaign issue for him. And so it's that kind of standard accountability transparency story where the governor gets a lot of privileges that come with being the governor. One of those is using a state plane, and a lot of people feel like they have the responsibility to be as open and transparent about that privilege as possible.
Well, we'll continue to follow both of your reporting on that issue. So we'll look forward to whatever comes next out of that. So we also want to spend our last few minutes together talking about the attorney general's race and the issues that the secretary of state is also facing. Let's start with the attorney general's race. Joe, it looks like these attorneys may end up in the courtroom before election day.
Yeah, definitely. There's been a lawsuit filed challenging the eligibility of the Republican nominee for Attorney General Daniel Cameron, saying that he has not practiced law for 8 years. And under the Kentucky Constitution, you have to be a practicing lawyer for 8 years. Now, Daniel Cameron, next month, Daniel Cameron will have the eighth anniversary of receiving his law license. So his campaign says, well, once, and it's 8 years before your election. So before Election Day, he will have been licensed 8 years as an attorney. The lawsuit, on the other hand, says that, well, it's not licensed attorney for 8 years, it's practicing attorney for 8 years. And because Cameron was a clerk for a federal judge for the first 2 years after he got his license, that calls into question whether he was practicing the entire time, because there are certain ethical codes of conduct for federal clerks where they're very limited circumstances in which they can actually practice law. They can't take any money. It has to be very limited subject matters that don't bleed over into issues that will come before the court that they clerk for. So the basic argument is saying, like, he's only been a practicing attorney for 6 years, therefore he's ineligible. Cameron's campaign has countered and pointed out a case from way back in 1995 when Ben Chandler was running for attorney general. A portion of his 8 years of being a practicing attorney, he was the state auditor. So they argued in that case that being an auditor isn't being a practice attorney. Chandler won that case, and the court decided that he was eligible. So Cameron's people are citing that as precedent that, yes, he is eligible to be attorney general, and he should not be thrown off the ballot.
And Daniel Cameron's campaign is facing this lawsuit not because it was filed by his Democratic challenger, former attorney general Greg Stumbaugh, who was also once House Speaker there in Frankfurt. Who filed this lawsuit?
So it was a private citizen in Louisville, a union guy. I'm blanking on his name right now. It begins with a J.
And Joseph Jackson.
yes, I have it here. Yeah, that's right.
I have a hard time making the argument that, you know, like, this is completely hands off. You know, it's a political lawsuit, no matter what. And I don't think that there's, you know, Greg Stumbaugh's hands might not be directly on this lawsuit. It may be coming from a private citizen. It certainly vibes with his campaign's argument that Daniel Cameron is not experienced enough to be attorney general.
Days before the lawsuit, Stumbaugh was in Western Kentucky repeating those same points. And then a couple of days later, the lawsuit comes. So it seems clear that that something might have been in the works if he was talking about it days before that was filed.
Joe, I have 30 seconds left. What happened to Secretary of State Allison Lundgren Grimes this week?
Well, she had the computers seized from her office. Daniel broke the story this week.
I'm sorry, I had that backwards.
Right after. Daniel might be able to explain that better than me.
Daniel, go ahead. I apologize for that.
No worries. So there's been an ongoing investigation into her office since October 2018 to determine whether or not she misused voter data or her office misused voter data. And so this week we found out that a computer that belonged to her, that was a state computer in her office, was seized by Kentucky State Police. The Secretary of State's office argued that they did not have a warrant or subpoena and said that, you know, they shouldn't have taken it. At the same time, you know, the argument on the other side is that it's state property, and so they're allowed to take it.
And this isn't related to her father being convicted last week?
This is not at all related to her father being convicted last week. This is a separate investigation that's been hanging over her head. It stems from complaints from the executive director of the State Board of Elections. He had issues with the way that she was kind of taking charge over the State Board of Elections, filed a complaint. He sent it to the Attorney General, to the Personnel Board, to the Executive Branch Ethics Commission, and to the State Board of Elections, and it kind of exploded. And that was the reason that the Secretary of State law got power stripped from her by the legislature this session. And so this whole thing it's been a rough year for Secretary of State Allison Lundgren Grimes.
Daniel DeRochers is from the Herald Leader. Joe Sonka is from the Courier Journal. Great reporting this week. We'll continue to follow for the latest updates. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you, Michael.
Yep, thank you.
And now we're joined live by WVXU reporter Ambriel Crutchfield, who is on the scene of a student-led protest about climate change. Ambriel, hello.
Hey.
Okay, so before we get into some questions, I believe you sent some sound back for us to play. Let's take a listen. Okay, Ambriel, am I hearing that correctly? Are they saying vote them out?
Yes. So this is a really multicultural and multigenerational group of people here, but it is a lot of young people, and they're very clear. If you're not on board with making sure that climate change, that we're preventing it as much as possible, then they're wanting to vote you out.
And this is something that's taking place all across the world today, and it is motivated and led by students. What's the turnout for the one here in Cincinnati?
Yeah, there are a lot of young people, high school students, college, also working adults. And there are also, I've seen people that look like they may be in like elementary school. I'm looking at a baby right now. So everyone is here, basically.
Okay, so have you been able to talk yet to any of the students to get some specifics about what their concerns are?
Yeah, so it's a variety of things. They want to halt using fossil fuels going forward. Their big concern is that we're, you know, in conversations, we're talking about how we can be eco-friendly as individuals by using reusable water bottles, et cetera. But they're like, that's not enough. We need corporations who are at the root of this problem to be taking the change and going forward. I actually see a sign that says the climate is changing. Why aren't we? So that's a pretty good summing up of how everyone here is reacting to the chance.
I think I missed a very obvious question at the beginning of this, Ambriel. Where exactly are you in town?
Yeah. I'm in front of City Hall, actually. So it's so many people that they're spilling onto the street. And while I was trying to get on the phone with you, I actually heard a police officer saying, hey, you all cannot be in the streets, because if you all get hit, then that's on us. So we need you to be moving onto the curb. And their thing is they can't really hear all the chants that are going on and the speeches that are being given. There have been people from Native American groups here talking, and a very heavy focus on, oh, there's some weird thing walking by me. It's a person with a lot of Kroger trash bags.
Oh, yeah, the bag guy. He's had a lot of environmental-related protests, I think, just to sort of represent the danger that plastic offers us.
I don't think I was expecting him.
Yeah, it's quite startling the first time you see it. It's a strange outfit, but I'm glad you finally got to see it since you're relatively new to town still. So you'll see that around on occasion. Ambriel, I do have to note, it's Friday. It is a school day. Have these student protesters taken the day off for this?
So actually, some of the students I was talking to, one of the organizers you saw, he goes to Walnut Hills and was planning to leave. I was going to meet him here. And then he was like, oh, well, we've been held up by the police that are saying we need our parent form. So they got held up 20 minutes late, and they came here on a mission and saying that's a problem, that they're being held up from being able to come and do something that is important. And this is something that a lot of students feel like this is more important than the academic schoolwork for today, because this is their future and their kids' future.
Well, Ambriel, we'll let you get back to reporting on this. We know that you'll have your stories here on WVXU on the air, 91.7, and also online at WVXU.org. Ambriel Crutchfield outside City Hall. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In 1955, Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling wrote a radio comedy about baseball. The show is about to have an encore presentation, thanks to WVXU and the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. And here to talk about it now is WVXU media writer John Kieswetter. He's on the phone as well. Hi, John.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad you could come on and talk about this. I know you popped by my office earlier in the week to give me a hint that this was coming, and you were very excited about it. So give us the background on this.
Well, actually, this was a television play that aired only once on NBC. On a Monday in December in 1955 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So,
it's being adapted then for radio.
It's been adapted for radio.
Gotcha.
It's unusual on a couple things. One, it was not recorded. There's no kinescope. It was before videotape, so nobody's ever seen it. Number two, it's a comedy. It's a comedy by Serling, who's known for his dramas like Requiem for a Heavyweight or Patterns or The Twilight Zone. but it's a comedy that was written at the height of the Cold War during the Red Scare about confusion between the Russians and the Cincinnati Reds.
Oh, that's awesome. And I understand that Rod Serling's daughter is involved.
Yes, his daughter, Anne, who lives up in upstate New York, is coming in, and she's going to be the narrator host we need to set it up and for a couple pieces in it. And students will be the actors, and then we're going to add sound effects and music and all. But this story has only been seen only once. In fact, when it was broadcast, Mary Wood, who was the TV critic at the Cincinnati Post, said, boy, this ought to be repeated in the evening, so baseball fans who might be at work would have a chance to see it. And so finally, probably early next year, WVXU is going to finally give them that repeat only about 65 years later.
Okay, so it's called O'Toole from Moscow, and it's about the confusion between the Red Scare and the Cincinnati Reds. Can you give us a little bit of more detail about what we might expect from it?
Yeah, there's two guys who work for the Russian embassy in New York who have high absenteeism, and the Russians are worried that they're meeting with spies or selling secrets or something. It turns out they're just baseball fans. They fell in love with baseball, and they were going to Ebbets Field. And so they're hauled into the office and told, we're going to send you back to Moscow for re-education. And so they go out on the lam, and they buy train tickets and go as far from New York as they can. And for the most money they had, they could get to Cincinnati. So they get to Cincinnati. And one of the two, the big, muscular, strapping young bodyguard, can't find any Russians at the sea, can't find anything he knows of the Reds or the Russians. So he goes to the Reds to turn himself in. Well, with a bit of fast talking, the Reds think he's asking for a tryout. So they try him out as an outfielder for the Cincinnati Reds, and it turns out he can hit better than Kozlowski. and he has this marvelous but brief major league career until the Russians find out where these two guys are there in Cincinnati, and try to take care of them, and that's where I won't give away the ending. That's the comedy of it. That there's this confusion between Russians and the Reds, and there's references to Musial and Jackie Robinson and Ted Kozlowski and Willie Mays. So it holds up fairly well.
Well, look, I've only got about 20 seconds left. It sounds hilarious, but you're the guy, John, our local media critic. You're the guy who adapted the script from the TV version to the radio.
It fell to me, but it was also a script that I knew about from when I first wrote about Serling's Cincinnati connection to the late 80s. So I've been looking for this thing for about 30 years, so we finally found it. And we've adapted it for radio, and it's going to be a blast.
Can't wait to see this to fruition. I know you're excited. Congratulations to you, and we'll follow you on the blog at WVXU.org to get updates. So thanks for joining us today, John.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Find archives of the program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.